Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Catch 67, The Left, the Right, and the Legacy of the Six-Day War, by Micha Goodman, narrated by Paul Bamer. Preface to the English edition. The Arab-Israeli conflict plays such a dominant role in the Israeli consciousness that it has all but taken over. While Israelis do care about questions of taxation, socio-economic inequality, and the relationship between religion and state, these issues rarely determine how they vote. Israelis vote for the parties that represent their positions on the conflict. The monopoly of the conflict within political discourse in Israel remains one of the unacknowledged consequences of the Six-Day War. How can the conflict be solved? Where should Israel's eastern border run? What will be the fate of Jerusalem? And what of the settlements? Proponents on both Israel's left and right have been arguing about these questions, and many others, for the past 50 years. Various attempts have been made to end the conflict, each reaching a dead end. The conflict remains active, and the debate over what to do about it continues to hurt Israeli society from within. Catch 67 is not about the Arab-Israeli conflict as such, but rather about the debate inside Israel about it. My journey into Israel's national political debate will be a journey into the heart of Israeli society. This debate is stormy, even fiery, but no one can hope to understand Israel without understanding the main argument that is being had within Israeli society. The problem with the current state of political debate is not confined to Israel or the Arab-Israeli conflict. Across much of Europe and the United States, political debate has stopped functioning. What is meant by a functional political debate? A disagreement between people, each of whom believes the other is wrong. I think you are wrong and you think I am wrong. That's how a good political debate ought to work. But what if I think you are not only wrong, but evil? Reasonable disagreement collapses. Social media tend to amplify this dynamic. People are increasingly concerned with labeling others, instead of thinking about their arguments. When they are exposed to new political ideas, they seldom think about whether the ideas are right or wrong. Instead, they ask, for example, whether they are liberal or conservative. Such people categorize ideas as a means of determining how to think about them. The effort to understand political arguments has been replaced by the desire to assign them to narrow categories. Such are the voices heard on social media in Israel. Oftentimes, right-wingers think not only that left-wingers are wrong, but that their openness to a territorial withdrawal makes them a threat to Israel, and perhaps even traitors. Oftentimes, left-wingers think not only that right-wingers are wrong, but that their opposition to a two-state solution makes them a danger to Israeli society, and perhaps even fascists. The poisonous debate in Israel exemplifies the poisoning of political conversation around the world. When each side thinks that the other's beliefs are not only wrong, but illegitimate, the capacity to listen vanishes, and reasonable disagreement collapses. Consider the difference between Israelis' conversations about politics and their conversations about technology. Differences of opinion about technological matters are aired with an openness that has created an elastic, energetic, and effective dialogue. As a result, Israelis have generated a tremendous amount of technological innovation in the past two decades, and Israel is known worldwide as an incubator for new ideas and out-of-the-box thinking. Listeners of this book might be surprised to learn that such a small country has produced more startup companies per capita than any major European nation. In recent years, Millions of people from around the world have visited Israel to learn about creativity and entrepreneurship from the startup nation. Visitors used to come to Israel primarily for its holy sites, such as the Western Wall and Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But today, many arrive to tour its companies, such as Waze and Mobileye. This is a new brand of tourism, and it tells a new story about the state of Israel. If people used to visit Israel for a look at the past, now they visit Israel for a glimpse of the future. But among those international visitors, eager to learn about technological innovation, none come to learn about political innovation. With regard to the most pressing issue for the Israeli public, the conflict with the Palestinians, Israel's creative edge disappears. When it comes to solving the conflict, Israelis find themselves recycling the same ideas over and over again. Much has been written about the secret of Israelis' creativity. The secret lies in a certain rare quality of conversation in Israel. Enter an Israeli company and you will be confronted with open discussion, group brainstorming, and a fruitful exchange of ideas. New ideas are met with enthusiasm. New thoughts are welcomed with encouragement. This is how Israelis create a climate conducive to the flourishing of new ideas. But in contrast to the technological conversation, the political conversation in Israel leads not to the exchange of ideas, but to the exchange of blows. Israelis do not listen to each other, they blame each other. Such intolerance cannot create an environment for the generation of innovative thinking. It can only block innovative thinking. Israelis, who argue so creatively about technology, argue unproductively about politics. When conversation dries up, creativity dries up along with it. I wrote this book originally in Hebrew for an Israeli readership. My purpose was to reflect back to Israelis their own arguments in a bid to heal their own national conversation. I wanted to show Israelis that for Israel to be politically and not just technologically groundbreaking, they needed not to try to win the political argument, but first and foremost to try to repair the political argument. Has this book achieved its goal in Israel? For now, it would appear not. Catch 67 was one of the most widely read books in Israel in 2017. It was publicly discussed by the heads of all the major parties, as well as Israel's leading opinion makers. Nevertheless, the book has failed to change or even calm the political debate in Israel. Instead of healing discord, the book itself sparked discord. Many right-wingers argued that I took a left-wing stance, while many left-wingers argued that I favored a right-wing position. A book whose author begged its readers to rise above attempts to categorize was itself subjected to countless attempts at categorization. Catch 67 focuses on the internal Israeli debate. As such, it contains analyses of different points of view and the deeper philosophies that underpin them. It is not a book about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and I provide little analysis of the internal debate among Palestinians. Nor is it a work of hasbara, an attempt to defend Israel, offering answers to various accusations hurled at Israel. I present neither a systematic treatment of the assaults on Israel's right to exist, nor a defense of that right. This is a book about how Israelis think, and the overwhelming majority of Israelis are arguing not about Israel's right to exist, but about its borders and its future. I did not write this book to defend Israel, but to explain it. In Catch 67, I explore the philosophical foundations of the governing ideologies of the Israeli left and right, as well as the clash between them. Most important, however, I also look at a surprising consequence of this clash. Though few commentators address it, and many may not realize it, most Israelis today have lost their sense of political conviction. They no longer identify with the ideologies of the left or the right. Most Israelis have lost their sense of certainty and been plunged into confusion, an outcome that may come as a surprise to foreign observers of Israel. This book is an exploration of Israel's old ideologies and how they led to this newfound confusion. If we can understand how this confusion arose and what it is doing to Israeli society, I argue we might see that it also presents an opportunity to move forward. Healing the fractured conversation about the conflict can pave a path toward new ideas that can help heal the conflict itself. Micha Goodman, February 2018, Jerusalem. Introduction. Can the Israeli national conversation be healed? On the eve of the Six-Day War, Israel formed a national unity government, a broad coalition of all major parties, for the first time in its history. Faced with an acute military threat from the United Arab Republic, a union of Egypt and Syria, not only was Israel's government united, the whole of Israeli society united as well, and a sense of solidarity spread among Jews across the country and throughout the world. This unity formed the backdrop for the greatest victory in Israel's history. In only 6 days of war, June 5th to 10th, 1967, the Israel Defense Forces, IDF, defeated a coalition of Arab armies, after the Egyptian President Gamal Abdel Nasser persuaded Jordan, Iraq, and Syria to ally with him and tripled the size of the country, capturing the Sinai Peninsula, the Golan Heights, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank. Yet, the conquest of these territories ignited a painful debate within Israel itself. Should these new territories be settled by Jews, or should they rather be relinquished to the Arabs in exchange for peace? Those who dreamt of keeping the land of Israel united clashed with those who dreamt of keeping it at peace, and the opponents tore Israeli society into two competing camps. The powerful sense of unity that had dominated on the eve of the war collapsed, ultimately, because of the results of that same war. Much has changed since then in the relationship between Israel and the Palestinian Arabs who live in the territories conquered in 1967. Israel has suffered the outbreak of two intifadas, among other crises, as well as three major rounds of violence in the Gaza Strip. It has endured the fateful years that followed the Oslo Accords, the years of disengagement from Gaza, and of repeated attempts to broker a permanent peace between the two sides. Not a single round of war secured victory, and not a single round of talks secured peace. But while these fruitless efforts to win victory or peace continued, an equally endless argument raged within Israel itself over where to draw the country's borders. The territories conquered in just 6 days of conflict sparked a debate that has endured for 50 years. Jewish tradition treats the 50th year as a jubilee. Every 50 years, slaves are liberated from their masters, all debts forgiven, and all lands returned to their former owners. The jubilee is the moment when the clocks are reset. Socioeconomic inequalities created over the preceding 50 years are eliminated, and all distinctions of status between master and slave are wiped away. After 50 years, it is as if the world is created anew. The jubilee year of the Six-Day War is an opportunity for Israelis to reset their internal argument and create their discourse anew. The opinions expressed and the arguments aired over the past 50 years have led both Israeli and Palestinian societies to a dead end. In biblical times, The 50th year was an opportunity for Jewish renewal, a chance for Jews to re-examine the basic assumptions of their political thought. But as a psychological precondition for reconfiguring their ways of thinking, Israelis must first adopt a radical change in the way they relate emotionally to those ways of thinking. Our emotional relationship to our opinions. The temptations of consumerism offer an endless distraction in the modern world and can shape people's core identity. Citizens in a consumer society tend to develop emotional and even intimate relationships with their possessions. In the most extreme cases of materialism, people regard their possessions as parts of their beings, not merely things that they own. Extreme materialism is similar to extreme idealism. Idealists struggle to differentiate themselves from their ideas. Their worldviews not only consist of collections of ideas, but form an integral part of their identity. Idealists identify with their ideas just as materialists identify with their possessions. People who assimilate their opinions into their identity become closed to criticism of those opinions. As they see it, any objection to their views is an assault on their being. Israel today is flooded with competing ideas. Israelis express a wide range of opinions on such matters as the economy and society, or the role of religion in the state, and the clashes between their ideas provoke lively and even stormy debate. Nevertheless, Israelis have absorbed their viewpoints into their very identity on one topic alone, the Arab-Israeli conflict. For Israelis, their opinions on the environment, say, or interest rates, play a part in how they think. In contrast, their opinions on where to place Israel's eastern border form a part of who they are. An Israeli who believes in withdrawing to the lines of June 4, 1967, is a leftist. An Israeli who believes in settling the disputed territories is on the right. In contrast to other political opinions, these positions shape how Israelis define not only the world, but themselves. To object to an Israeli's position on the conflict is to object to his or her core identity. Therein lies the paradox. On the issue that matters to them the most, Israelis are the least capable of listening to one another. The Israeli right believes that the ideas of the left are not just wrong, but dangerous. A withdrawal from the mountains of Judea and Samaria would leave Israel shrunken, weakened, vulnerable, and doomed to physical destruction. The Israeli left believes that the ideas of the right are not just wrong, but dangerous. A continued military and civilian presence in the disputed territories would leave Israel morally dilapidated, internationally isolated, and doomed to demographic destruction. The right sees the left exactly as the left sees the right. The right is convinced that the left's vision will cause Israel's total collapse, and the left is convinced that the right's vision will cause Israel's total collapse. How can an Israeli, on either the right or the left, listen to a fellow citizen whose vision spells disaster for the entire country? In Israel, the conversation about borders is unique among political arguments because of these two features: an Israeli's own opinions are a part of his or her identity, and others' opinions are a threat to his or her existence. The combination of these two characteristics has prevented either side from listening to the other and has caused the collapse of Israeli political dialogue. Israelis do not view discussions of the conflict as a brainstorming exercise to provoke original thinking, challenge preconceptions, or nurture new and creative ideas. Israeli political debate becomes less an exchange of ideas than an affirmation of identities. The fiery tone of the debate has led to ideological and intellectual rigidity, a clearly disturbing result. The Arab-Israeli conflict is a complex subject, but the way Israelis think about it is not complex at all. What remains is an asymmetry between the profundity of the problem and the superficiality of the thinking it provokes. The 50th year of this enduring conversation offers Israelis the opportunity to start over, but only if they have the courage to detach their opinions from their identities. Jewish dialogue versus Israeli dialogue. One way to detach opinions from identities might be through inspiration from the Talmud, which describes a dispute between two leading schools of thought in the first century CE. Beit Shammai, the house of the scholar Shammai, and Beit Hillel, that of Rabbi Hillel. For 3 years, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel disagreed, records the Talmud. These said, the halakha, religious law, is in accordance with our opinion, and these said, the halakha is in accordance with our opinion. Ultimately, a divine voice emerged and proclaimed, both these and those are the words of the living God. However, the halakha is in accordance with the opinion of Beit Hillel. Who is correct, Beit Shammai or Beit Hillel? According to the divine voice, they are equally correct. The opinions of both of them are the words of the living God. But even though they are both right, they cannot both determine religious law, which follows Beit Hillel. How could this be? The Talmud explains. Since both these and those are the words of the living God, why were Beit Hillel privileged to have the halakha established in accordance with their opinion? The reason is that they were agreeable and forbearing, showing restraint when affronted, and when they taught the halakha, they would teach both their own statements and the statements of Beit Shammai. Moreover, when they formulated their teachings and cited a dispute, they prioritized the statements of Beit Shammai to their own statements, in deference to Beit Shammai. Scholars belonging to Beit Shammai refused to hear or listen to the positions of Beit Hillel. They would study and teach their own positions exclusively. Scholars belonging to Beit Hillel, however, taught their own positions only after first hearing and listening to those of the rival Beit Shammai. In the end, God chose Beit Hillel to determine religious law because its scholars chose not to listen only to themselves. Ultimately, religious law is determined not by the side that is right, but by the side that is willing to listen. Listening, however, comes at a price. Beit Shammai did not change its positions even once during its many arguments with Beit Hillel, but Beit Hillel ended up backtracking and changing its positions several times, accepting the arguments of its rivals. Listening means risking one's own beliefs. The scholars of Beit Hillel took the risk and therefore got to make the decision, not because they were always right, but precisely because they were aware that they were not always right. The school of Beit Hillel was neither full of doubt nor void of conviction. On the contrary, its scholars were firm in their beliefs and declared unambiguously, "The halakha is in accordance with our opinion." And still, despite the strength of their convictions, they refused to become intimately connected with those convictions. They were careful to keep a healthy distance between themselves and their opinions. This is the critical distance that prevents our opinions from completely taking over our identity. This appealing Talmudic anecdote teaches that religious law is determined, paradoxically, by those who are not wedded to their own beliefs. Could this Talmudic paradox serve as a model for modern Israel? Could the healthy self-doubt of Beit Hillel pierce the armor of modern Israeli political discourse? For Israelis to rehabilitate their national conversation about the conflict, they must first repair their own emotional relationship to their own opinions. The emotional tempest undermining discussion of the conflict, however, pales in comparison with the emotional tempest of the conflict itself. The emotional trap. The rift between Israelis and Palestinians is perpetuated by a destructive psychological dynamic. The clash between these two nations is also a clash of emotions. The dominant emotion among Israelis is fear. Israelis fear the Palestinians. This fear is ancient, deep, and common to Israelis of all political stripes. The sound of someone speaking Arabic sets off alarm bells for left-wing and right-wing Israelis alike. The dominant emotion among Palestinians is not fear, but humiliation. Palestinians are not afraid of Israelis, but they feel humiliated by them. The conflict between these two nations is a clash of emotions, specifically a painful confrontation between fear and humiliation. These emotions nurture and aggravate one another. The Israelis' fear of Palestinians pushes them to take defensive steps, such as placing restrictions on Palestinians' movement, delaying their passage through checkpoints, and questioning them at the entrances to public spaces. The Palestinians' sense of humiliation grows deeper as a result of these actions. But the destructive dynamic does not end here. This humiliation inflames the existing feelings of hatred and anger and creates a climate that breeds violence. Violence that in turn heightens the Israelis' sense of fear. Tragically, the Israelis' sense of fear provokes actions that deepen the Palestinians' sense of humiliation, and the Palestinians' sense of humiliation provokes reactions that heighten the Israelis' sense of fear, and so on and so forth. When fear and humiliation collides, each becomes stronger. This dynamic characterizes not only the personal relationships between the two nations, but the political one too. One of the most important goals for the Palestinians is to craft an accord with Israel that does not humiliate them. In contrast, the most important demand for Israelis is to craft an accord with the Palestinians that does not endanger them. And therein lies the problem. The satisfaction of Israel's security needs is bound to injure the Palestinians' karama, their national pride. Consider one example. Most Israelis would probably not support an accord unless the Palestinian state were demilitarized. Moreover, Israelis generally insist that this demilitarization should be enforced, among other steps, by the Israel Defense Forces' continued security control of the Jordan Valley. But this demand is humiliating for the Palestinians. An Israeli military presence on the soil of a Palestinian state would strike a painful blow to its sovereignty and perpetuate the prevailing sense of occupation and humiliation. Yet, both sides have right on their side. For Israelis, a military presence in the Jordan Valley is a necessity on which they cannot compromise. For Palestinians, that military presence is a national humiliation to which they cannot possibly agree. One further example. Most Israelis would probably reject an accord that closed Palestine's airspace to the Israeli Air Force. The reasons are straightforward. Only through freedom of the skies could Israel supervise Palestine's demilitarization, hold necessary training exercises, and ensure the security of its own skies. But there could be no greater humiliation for the Palestinians than to have Israeli jets flying above their heads on a daily basis. Yet again, both sides are right. The same steps that would allay the Israelis' sense of fear would also exacerbate the Palestinians' sense of humiliation. This is a zero-sum game between one nation's national honor and another's national security. As a result, any agreement that would satisfy Israel's security needs would be perceived as one that perpetuated Israel's control over the Palestinians, and therefore humiliated them.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?